So use satellite data sets to look at some global fire patterns. Talk a little bit about conceptual modeling, a model for explaining large-scale fire activity. I'll move on to quantifying fire emissions, which I actually spend most of my time on doing that, but it's, well, rather boring, so I'll move quickly to relations between climate and deforestation. And I'll end with a study from the Boreal region, I think something showing where our field is heading to integrate different perspectives on how climate or how fires actually influence climate. And just to start with, let it get a little bit controversial. What is fire, and then really mean from an atmospheric perspective? We all know plants grow by, you know, using CO2 from the atmosphere, water and sunlight, shed their leaves, and CO2 is released to the atmosphere again as respiration. That's one of the part of the cycle. You know, it keeps growing, 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 etc. But besides the pathway of respiration, we also have a pathway of fire, which is shown here. So as long as this cycle keeps on going, fire is not a net source of CO2 to the atmosphere. I think it's we know it, but still it's important to emphasize. Only if you have deforestation or if you have an increase in fire frequency, then you have a net source of CO2. So from a CO2 perspective, that's what I mentioned earlier, a fire is not much more than fast respiration. However, there's obviously much more. And this is a slide. Paulus showed it yesterday, and I think it's good to mention it once more. Most of us are familiar with it, but it definitely shows the importance of fire in the global climate system. What this shows, it's a graph from the IPCC, the Forest Assessment Report. It shows radiated forcing, so basically the amount of energy that's available top of the atmosphere compared to pre-industrial times. Everything in red is positive radiated forcing, basically enhancing, for example, greenhouse effect. Everything in blue, negative radiated forcing, having a cooling effect. And the good thing about radiated forcing is that you can compare different drivers of the climate system with each other. The thing that's it's always nice to show, I think. If you think about fire, Paulo showed this yesterday also, basically it has an effect on all the different anthropogenic factors driving climate change. And CO2, historically speaking, something that Ruth touched upon yesterday, for long periods, CO2 emissions from fire, so the deforestation emissions, have been same order of magnitude as fossil fuel emissions, but also, Colin mentioned earlier, right now it's just a different order of magnitude. I mean, CO2 emissions from fires or deforestation emissions are definitely small compared to fossil fuel emissions. Okay, so far for some background information. Just a few pictures of, if you really look at large scale patterns, what are the four major biomes or vegetation types that burn? I guess the big stand replacing fires in boreal or maybe temperate regions. Savanna fires, much more frequent, but burning only the herbaceous layer. Agriculture waste burning, and finally, net emissions from deforestation. And if you put this in a simple conceptual model, which I'm going to also use to estimate emissions, and you plot fuel load versus fire return time, and those numbers are just an indication. I mean, this is very conceptual. You have those different vegetation types, so savanna fires burning relatively frequent, but because they burn relatively frequent, also there's not a lot of biomass. Temperate forests, boreal forests, I put it up a little bit higher because it's not just the biomass that's burning, it's also the organic soil. And then right on top, tropical forests, high biomass loads, high fuel loads, but very low fire frequency. Now, I think what I want to put on top of this is sort of the human influence, but after hearing some of the talks from Tom, but also earlier, I think this should be basically seen as what's happened since probably the last 100 years or so. Savanna fires are burning much more frequently than they used to be, I think. Temperate forests, I don't know where things are going to, whether you have fire exclusion and you build a biomass and you lower your fire frequency, or whether you have warming and you get more fires. Boreal forest, in general, I'm thinking, okay, it's well, definitely there's a human component, but the natural component is also that it's warming. So normally you see warm years, more fires, so you will get a decrease in the fire frequency and leading probably at some point to lower biomass loads. Tropical forest, of course, the most extreme. In case of deforestation, bang, you go to fire frequency of 1 year for a few years and you lower your fuel load, get to the same point as savanna. So that's just a little bit introduction. This idea of fuel load versus fire return time, like to expand a little bit on. What you see on top is a similar graph as Mark showed earlier, except this is from a different satellite product, just the number of times a fire is recorded within a single grid cell, in this case 1 degree grid cells. So that's on top. And on the bottom, modeled net primary production. And coming back to a concept we've seen earlier, you have very low net primary production, of course, no fires on top. And you move to gradient with higher productivity in the rainforest. You also go to regions where you don't have fire activity because it's just too moist, or, well, basically, maybe there's no humans. Anyway, if you conceptualize this, sorry, that's probably next graph. If you plot this data over gradient, what you've just seen, here a gradient, this is for Africa, all of Africa, net prime production very low in desert areas. You have a very low burn fraction going to the savanna areas where you have higher productivity and still a relatively long dry season. You get some optimum, and then you level off again going to the tropical forest areas. If you do the same exercise for tropical America, you see exactly what Max showed earlier, that this, it doesn't level off the way it does in Africa, basically because you have, it's also partly dominated by deforestation, so people just go into the high NTP areas and still use fires. Anyway, what I want to show, if you conceptualize this again, you have to, again, the gradient precipitation, so very low, say, desert areas into tropical forest areas. I cut out a few places to basically show what William Bond saying, sort of the biome that hasn't been defined, so where probably a precipitation and factual takeoff of biomass aren't fully related due to fires. You see what I plotted here in red, basically everything where you have fire, and here it's just too dry, there's no biomass, here it's too wet. So this would be for average year. But now, thinking of the tropics, if you think what this means for interannual variability. So I'm not going to talk about average years, I'm going to talk about years or wet years. Think about a drought year, so for example Indonesia, but also Australia, El Nino year, very dry conditions. You would move into areas that's normally where you cannot burn. So suddenly this part becomes, becomes vulnerable to fire. On the other hand, areas that normally receive just enough precipitation to sustain the fire won't burn anymore. And for La Nina year, it's the other way around. Now, this is just a way of thinking about it. And using satellite data again, I'm going to see whether this works or not. So what we did using the satellite data, so say for over 10 years, we defined a fire season, so shown here, with some peak fire month. And that same for the same satellite data, this is also from TWIM, measuring a precipitation from space. You have your precipitation. So you sort of can see the intensity during your fire season and also the precipitation during your fire season. So this would be important in tropical forest areas, for example. If you have a drought, you would expect more fires versus fuel-limited areas, for example, interior of Australia, where you would expect a drought to have lower biomass and lower fuels. lower fire, excuse me. So if you plot this, it's maybe a little bit complicated graph, but the only thing that's important is that everything in red, so let's focus on this area where you have the strongest climate anomalies on interannual scales. Everything in red is exactly what you think is going on. You get a drought, you get more fires. In Australia, you get a drought, you get less fires. This is working pretty well in those extreme climate regions. And you also see it in other regions, for example, in Africa, like in dry areas, you do get an increase in fire in wet years. While more in the woodlands, a drought actually lowers fire activity in the arid regions, in the woodlands the other way around. But you also see that many grid cells don't show this response. And these are really the areas with intermediate productivity, where interannual variability in climate isn't that important. I think human influence are definitely much more important. But if you look at interannual scales, total emissions, what you want to do now, where I want to go, is so a drought actually increased fire activity over here, decreased fire activity over there. But on a global scale, which one is more important? So if you want to say something about it, you have to quantify emissions. And that's actually what I spent doing my PhD. The concept of calculating fire emissions on a scale is pretty simple. You need three sources of information. Burnt area, you want to know how much biomass or fuel load there is, and you want to know which fraction of this biomass actually was combusted. Well, this is all done on pretty large scale, so we have to rely on satellite data. The burnt area is normally done looking at time series. For example, here you have something July 2000, and a few months later you see a big change, so you kind of know your burnt area. For fuel load, we use a simple biogeochemical model to calculate the spatial distribution of biomass and fuel load. Basically, each grid cell, for each month, you calculate a net primary productivity, net primary production, based on satellite-derived NDVI and FBAR, available radiation and light use efficiency. So your net primary production is used in combination with fractional tree cover maps to build your above ground biomass and below ground biomass. So high net prime production, high fractional tree cover, which, for example, in tropical forests lead to high biomass loads. Okay, that's one part of the story. What's happening? This biomass at some point dies, becomes litter, and litter respires. So basically a very simple carbon cycle model. CO2 from the atmosphere going in, becoming biomass, becoming litter, respires to the atmosphere. Now, part of the story, of course, we're interested in fire emissions. So, in the model, it was an existing model, we put combustion as another pathway. So based on area burned, combustion completions, etc., you take part of the above-ground biomass and above-ground litter, also below-ground litter and feed areas, you take it, and herbivory we included, otherwise we didn't get the fuel loads and savannas right. What this shows, I think, is also that combustion and respiration sort of compete, you know, for the available biomass in combination with herbivory. So that's just the way we've done it. For each month, for each grid cell, we calculate emissions. And this is sort of what you get. Remember, this is just a model we've been using. It's pretty uncertain because, well, the input data sets are uncertain, and also 1-degree modeling. Well, we all know that the world isn't the same over grid cells of 100 by 100 kilometers. But it is sort of an indication, and most models seem to converge a little bit on this number of 2.5 petagrams of carbon per year. So remember, this is all emissions, not just deforestation emissions. And if you want to break down that about 50% of the emissions coming from Africa, about 10% from the boreal region, quite some deforestation actually going on here. China has a moratorium on fire emissions, but everything around China, see a lot of deforestation and emissions. So 50% from Africa, 10% from the boreal region, a little bit less than 10% from Australia, and the remaining 30% sort of South America, Arctic deforestation, and quite some emissions in Indonesia. So again, this 2.5 petagram of carbon per year, it's difficult to interpret. It's much lower, of course, in respiration. It's also quite a bit lower than fossil fuel emissions. But of this 2.5 petagram, I think only half a petagram or so are really net emissions. So next step, I want to emphasize again, this number is pretty uncertain. And for working on it, you can, of course, decrease uncertainty, having better input data sets. That's what we're actually doing now. We're increasing spatial resolution, etc. But another way to sort of get a handle on your uncertainty, because now even the uncertainty is uncertain, we don't know, is using atmospheric carbon measurements of carbon monoxide, something Paolo also showed a movie from. Right now we can measure carbon monoxide from space pretty well. You see some plots, for example, here. South America in the wet season, still there's carbon monoxide in the atmosphere, for example, from methane oxidation or emissions from fossil fuels. But then in the burning season, you have much higher concentrations. And the good thing about carbon monoxide is that biomass burning is the main source of it. So if you levels, you know it's from biomass burning. And we talked quite a bit about South America. I want to focus a little bit on the Indonesia region. So we will a little bit attention to all the different regions. And I'm going to use this these measurements of carbon monoxide to sort of validate our bottom-up emissions. So again, this is for the area around Indonesia. It's a time series, 2001 to 2006. This is a model, so with all the different sources of carbon monoxide, methane oxidation, etc. And you see, well, there's not a lot of interannual variability. You go every year. Basically, the high the seasonality is related to different wind fields. The high numbers is when the winds basically coming from China. But you also see if you plot Muppet measurements on top of this, that you have some peaks which you cannot explain with your normal sources. And well, needless to say, biomass burning, especially in Indonesia, is very much related to ENSO. Some years, like 2002, you had a moderate El Nino, 2006 as well. Those are exactly those areas when this doesn't fit to each other. So if you add all your sources, add biomass burning, then you can much better represent your Muppet measurements. That's shown over here. I must add that we had to adjust our bottom-up emissions a little bit. So this is basically a trick you do. You get your best bottom-up measurements, then you adjust them a little bit so you get the best fit with atmospheric constraints. Now, why do we want to do this? Of course, to get an uncertainty estimate, but also to improve our bottom-up emissions. And this is, it's again, maybe a little bit, quite a bit of information on the one plot. But let's focus on the blue line. These are, again, just optimized emissions. So what we did, just the bottom-up emissions constrained by satellite data. And this is averaged by season precipitation. So very dry to relatively wet. So say El Nino conditions to La Nina conditions. And what you see here is emissions for 10 different years. 1997 up here. I must add that wasn't constrained by Muppet because it wasn't flying yet, but it's extrapolated. 2006, also El Nino. 2002, El Nino. And then going normal years to La Nina years. And this is basically, if we talk about feedbacks, I think this is one of the, for fire at least, it's one of the important ones. You just see, as soon as you hit a certain threshold, you know, the difference between 2002 and 2007 in length of dry season is pretty small, but your emissions are much higher. We're talking about almost half a petagram, so it's substantial. The other data sets is just different satellite products to show that this is not an effect, I think, of the data set. So why is this happening? We thought, okay, this intranuclear variability could be that most peat fires burning, but with nice collaboration with a lot of people from the University of Maryland. This is work Jan Demperwolf did. For the same period, except, well, we didn't go before 2000, we looked at intranuclear variability and rates of forest loss. So this is only for southern Borneo. It's a pretty large area. But you see the same pattern. 2000, La Niña year, very low forest loss. 2002, El Niño high. 2006, another El Niño, very high. So basically what's happening, it's very dry. People take advantage of it. That's one part of the story. Probably also more fires that go out of control, etc. But it shows the importance of climate on deforestation rates, I think. Maybe some background information wouldn't hurt. For those who are not familiar with the region, why is Indonesia so important for emissions? Well, let's focus on the region over here. It's lowland. There's a lot of peat deposits for long periods. But in 1996, I think, Suharto said, okay, let's stop importing rice. We want to grow it ourselves. So what they did, part of the region, you see here the natural drainage channel. They added a lot of anthropogenic drainage channels to sort of drain the peat. You see an example over here. The problem, of course, if you drain the peat, if it becomes very dry, well, just a big El Niño, in combination with humans, you get a lot of emissions. So that's also what you see here, actually, the drainage pattern. And you see everything from red, you see one fire over a certain period, up to 10 fires over a certain period, which shown. You see a lot of fires in one specific spot. You know it's high biomass. It has to be deforestation or peat burning. So I was really intrigued by the nonlinearity. I think that's basically a scary part of climate predictions. You've got nonlinearity in the system. It's difficult to take them well into account. Well, the causes for the nonlinear relation, which we saw earlier, first of all, there's a threshold. Every system with a threshold shows nonlinearity. The threshold basically here is if it's just raining a lot, you don't see any fires, very simple. The second one is during a drought, what we looked at the different years, we see that during droughts, the fires actually happen further away from the drainage channels. Kind of makes sense, but you get a larger area that's becoming vulnerable to fire. And the one we just saw earlier, the forest loss is much higher during drought, so you get this amplification. And I think this is sort of a... We talk a lot about carbon climate feedbacks or feedbacks in general, but they normally, I mean, if you think of feedback, you think of increased respiration because it's warm, etc. Sort of natural processes that are acting because, well, because it's warm. Anyway, this is really a human-driven feedback, I think. Droughts lead to higher deforestation rates because humans take advantage of climate conditions. Higher deforestation rates, of course, more CO2 emissions, and higher CO2 concentrations may lead to more drought. This is also what Paulus showed yesterday, I think, climate models. It's not obvious whether we're going to go to drought or not. And this is a little bit controversial, I think, especially after talking yesterday with Jennifer. If you build on this the importance of drought for these fire emissions in tropical regions, what I plotted here is just all the regions that are mapped as tropical forests. And we constructed a very simple scalar, which we call the FDP, the fire deforestation potential, which is basically a scalar indicating the length and the intensity of the dry season. So if you have a long dry season with hardly any precipitation, it's high, and if it's always wet, it's very low. That's the pattern you see over here. For example, Indonesia region we were just talking about, it's pretty low. It's normally just too wet. But if you look at standard deviation, you basically see the regions that are impacted by ENSO. So high standard deviation. So even if it's on average too wet, you have some years when it's dry enough. But the thing that really intrigues me is that if you look at South America, the Arc of Deforestation over here, this is a region where it's dry basically almost every year. Standard deviation is pretty low. So conditions for deforestation aren't too difficult. However, if you go further to the interior, at some point you get to a climate that's rather similar to Asia. So does this mean that's a natural break on deforestation? I always thought so, but Jennifer pointed out, yeah, but even in those regions, if you have a month when it's really dry and you chop down the forest, it may be still possible to use fire as a tool for deforestation. However, it definitely is going to be more complicated. And to show the importance sort of the importance of drought, what I plotted here is so the FDP, so this fire deforestation potential versus fire detections. So you see everywhere that as soon as it becomes drier, you get more fire detections, of course. So a little bit of a conclusion. It seems that humans take advantage of drought to use fire more efficiently as a tool for deforestation. And I think if you think about it, you need both drought and you need humans to get high deforestation emissions, also following up on what Ruth's been saying. I have a few slides on the global implications of this, some work we've done earlier. I think it's important that you need both. You need drought and you need humans. Just taking a step back, we've seen this graph also earlier. CO2 concentrations measured with a network of flasks going from 1981 to 2005. We're all familiar with the story, increasing image or increasing concentration due to the combustion of fossil fuel. Seasonal cycle, basically, because there's more land in the northern hemisphere. But if you take those two effects out, so you take the trend out, you take the seasonal cycle, you end up with the growth rate. I think this one is really important if you think about carbon climate feedbacks, because what we want to know whether the future, will it be low growth rate, will it be high growth rate, whatever. And to predict something, we can use the interannual variability to come at the causes of this interannual variability CO2 growth rate. First of all, I think it's important this variability is not related to CO2 emissions. They're relatively constant, of course. There's some fluctuation, but not as much as this. Most measurements point out that the oceans aren't a big player in this. Furthermore, it's important. The high growth rates normally happen during El Nino periods, and the low growth rates during La Nina periods or after volcanic eruptions. And this has been traditionally explained by an offset between photosynthesis and respiration. So during El Nino period, normally it's dry and it's warm. If it's dry, then plants have more difficulty with photosynthesis, so they take less CO2 out of the atmosphere. If it's warm, then microbes are thought to be happier, so they release more CO2. However, if you look a little bit further, and this started with a paper by Langefeldt et al. 6 years ago. If you not only look at CO2, so these are plots going from northern hemisphere, equator, southern hemisphere, and then in time, this is from 92 to 2000, seeing the same thing which we just saw, high growth rate of CO2 during 94, and then high growth rate again, 97, 98. But it's not just CO2, it's also isotopes, which are actually lower, hydrogen, methane, CO. So the only logical explanation, the only process that can explain all those different ones is fires. And that's actually, we build a little bit on the work from Langefeldt et al. We want to know, okay, if it's fires, from which regions is it coming from? So what we looked at is the period from 97 to 2001. Made some anomaly maps, and you see this is, for example, the anomaly of the 97-98 El Nino. The much higher emissions in basically all the deforestation regions, and also southern Africa, which afterwards wasn't probably realistic. Anyway, the thing is, with our modeling work, we could explain about two-thirds of the intra-annual variability in CO2 growth rates. We got this into science, and I think not because it shows how important fires are, but it shows that basically classic modeling of taking photosynthesis and respiration doesn't really work, especially if you take it to the tropics. I must add, however, that we're pretty sure that we thought it was two-thirds, but it seems to be more 50%, that this is quite an anomaly. And it's also not only the tropics you had higher emissions, also the boreal region, so it's sort of a conspiracy. If you go to over here, we don't see much variability, so there's definitely this is, you know, work in progress, I think. Okay, just I have one more slide, but if I want to have like three take-home messages, these would be it. I think that with a simple conceptual model, you can explain a large part of the interannual and the spatial variability in fire activity patterns, but mostly at the extreme parts of the spectrum. So in desert areas, you see you get more fires after an anomalous precipitation event, etc. In the middle, it really seems that the humans are important, or herbivory, etc. But it's, I mean, from a simple point of view, it's very difficult to model this. I guess with a TGVM or so, that would be more realistic. The second part, according to our modeling work, this is an average from the 97 to 2006 period. Think about emissions are about 2.5 petagrams of carbon per year. Colin mentioned a range from 2 to 4 petagrams of carbon. That seems to be, I mean, most of the other estimates are actually lower, but it's definitely not lower. It may be a little bit more, so 2 to 4 petagrams. That seems like a very realistic range. However, most of those emissions are compensated by regrowth. So if you do a very simple calculation, only taking the emissions stemming from deforestation grid cells, and root of these, that actually a much more elaborate work on this, then you get about a fifth or a quarter of those emissions are net emissions. So it's a substantial number, but it's much smaller than people have been using in REDD programs, for example. And I must add, you know, fire emissions are only part of deforestation. Of course, there's also decomposition. Plus emissions, oxidation and peat is a big wildcard. But if you use fire emissions as a proxy for deforestation emissions, then it really shows that, well, basically the importance of fossil fuel is so much more important than deforestation. And it also shows that if you say, okay, let's tackle climate change by using or slowing deforestation rates, then I think it's not the right way to do it. The last one, during drought periods, humans take advantage of those conditions. If you want to deforest, it's obviously much easier to do it when it's really dry. So fire is used more effectively as a tool for deforestation, and this leads to a positive feedback, positive carbon climate feedback. And it also leads to the conclusion that fires can explain part of the interannual variability in CO2 and methane growth rates. And finally, I want to show one more slide. And I think that's sort of where at least my field is heading towards. I've been looking a lot at CO2 and methane, etc. But if you remember the slide from the IPCC, of course, climate is much more than greenhouse gases. And Jim Mendelson had a paper 3 years ago in Science where they looked at boreal forest fires. And they looked at different years. So they followed a fire that happened, I think, 1 year ago and 6 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't just look at CO2 and methane, but they did a lot of modeling and they took albedo into account. And basically what it shows here is stand age. So year zero, you had your fire and you go down 150 years in time. Here again, there's radiative forcing. So everything positive basically warms climate. Everything negative warms it, cools the climate. And if you look at CO2 and methane, you see exactly what you expect. You know, you have your fire, you have CO2 emissions, so you warm the climate a little bit, but as time progresses, methane is broken down, CO2 is taken up by the vegetation or by the oceans, and it levels off going to zero. Of For ozone and aerosols, aerosols mostly black carbon falling on snow, lowering the albedo, you have a very strong effect in the beginning, but this is really a matter of years until it goes down again. So these two effects basically form the climate. However, albedo in these regions that are covered by snow is so important. If as soon as you if you have a snow layer, of course you have very high reflectivity. So if you have your forest, on the other hand, the reflectivity is much lower. So if you cut your forest, either by burning or cutting, your albedo becomes much higher, so you cool the climate. So if you add all these effects, basically you come to the notion that boy, forest fires cool the climate. Now this is exceptional. This is only in regions that are covered by snow, but it shows the importance of combining all different perspectives. I think it's also, I mean, so far I always thought about boreal forest fires. It's becoming warmer, so we get more fires, so more CO2 emissions, so warmer, etc. Really feedback, but it shows that it's a little bit more complicated. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
This estimate of 0.5 petagrams of carbon, how reliable is it? Because it's a very low bar.
Yeah. I think this is also a number where we don't know the uncertainty on. So what we're doing now, we're actually with sort of tagging all the CO2 emissions, whether they come from deforestation or not. And then we, same as what we thought, what we looked at with the CO, we compared them to CO measurements. And that's actually a work in progress. But maybe 0.5 is low, but it's not more than one. That's one thing.
Because in Amazonia, you know, it's about 100 tons of carbon, biomass, you know, per hectare, you know. And of course, if you change that for a pasture or for a soybean plantation, it's a few percent of that amount. So it's not just a factor of four, but much, much lower than that.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, that's one thing.
I mean, what the soil carbon?
Yeah. We've been doing some high resolution modeling, and actually, for the state of Mato Grosso, we come at about 100 teragrams of carbon per year.
How much?
100. So, but that's only Mato Grosso. So if you double that, say, for the event, you come to 200. For the Indonesia, you also get about 150 to 200 teragrams of carbon per year on average. That's validated. So then total you have 400 teragrams. Then you have Africa, 500 at most. Don't pay too much attention maybe to this number 0.5. The thing, my message is really, it's not, I mean, deforestation emissions, not the 2 petagrams of carbon per year that people have been assuming always in the REDD things. 0.5, maybe it's 0.6, 0.7, maybe it's even, but I'm pretty sure it's not, but it's, yeah. Yeah. No, you're totally right. Also, I mean, the publications, they vary between 0.5 and 2.1 or so. It's what does your work comment? Maybe it's also, I think this, I mean, you see there's a lot of variability in the estimates, but I think if you focus on that, that's one thing where fires are really important, I think. If you focus on the fire emissions, at least those is something we can validate. You don't have the whole story, you don't have decomposition, but it's, if you assume that fire is deforestation, you can get a long way.
But aren't we arguing, when circling around the question, that if you take the world and transform it to a flammable, totally flammable biome. The question is, what's the difference in the carbon storage? You're saying that its impact is maybe not as much as we expect because plants grow back.
Well,
what's the potential difference if we do that?
I think a quick calculation, the Amazon, 70 petagrams of carbon, Indonesia, including peats, a little bit more, but you come at 200 petagrams of carbon. So if you convert it to fascial, basically, then well, all the carbon is in the atmosphere, but that's 20 years of fossil fuel emissions, which is a lot, but I mean, converting everything to fascial is also a serious scenario. I mean, it's definitely, especially with the feedback, it's a substantial number, but it's not as substantial as people have been thinking. I think that's my main message. Yeah, what we did, for example, is one, I think that it's a very neat study. We looked at visibility data from Indonesia, what's measured, and then we looked at drought. And what you see that right, the last 2 decades per unit drought, if I may express it that way, you get much more emissions than you used to get. So it also, I think, I mean, fires definitely play a role in explaining inter-annual variability, but it's not the only thing. I mean, if you go back in time, it's not as important as it is now. Not at this number, but I think that's sort of the traditional way of viewing deforestation. And now, if Mato Grosso is 50% of Brazil deforestation, combustion completeness, you know, you've seen the graphs, it's 90 or 100%.
Oh, yeah.
The same in Indonesia. I mean, redox station is a big thing, but the fires are also a big thing. So, I mean, the 0.5 or, well, I don't, 0.5 maybe is not the right number, but definitely lower than 1. You know, there's something to be added on top of that. But it's not, yeah. There is abandonment.
This will be the last question.
So far, boreal ceasefires have been the major amount of tropical ceasefires.
I wouldn't say that. On average, depends, I think. It's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, in the tropical or in the boreal fires, I mean, 80% of the emissions is coming from the soils, so it's an important fraction. But I mean, if you have years like 97, 98, you get a petagrams of carbon, a petagram of carbon from Indonesia, then it doesn't matter. But I mean, on average, it's definitely, it is a fraction.
How about we have lunch and come back at 1:45? Because we've got a terrific couple of talks after lunch.